Dave Jensen.
Steel Wagstaff.
Good evening, man. It's so good to hear your sweet dulcet tones. Dave, you know, a lot of people have been writing us, and I've had to talk a few people down from doing really drastic things that might have harmed themselves in their future because they thought we were done making podcasts after the last Off the Chain.
We have great news for those people. Great news for the whole world, really.
Yeah.
I think what we're going to bring the people is going to be something they really enjoy and won't take 2 hours of their time every time they want to listen to us.
No. Dave, we're calling this theme songs.
Yeah. Steele, one thing that you and I have always loved doing is talking about music together. Yeah. We love sharing songs back and forth. Clem Snide, one of my favorite artists ever, you introduced me to. And that's something that we've always just enjoyed going back and forth. And now we got theme songs for people.
And Dave, there's even a little song to commemorate the occasion.
Oh, yeah, please share.
You are the first. You are the first. Because you
So this is the first episode of Theme Song, Steele.
It is. You are the first, Dave, to do this to me. That's Konomichi.
Konomichi. Makes me feel very uncomfortable.
Perfect. We're off to a great start.
So just to lay it out for the people, what this podcast is going to be is each time we release a podcast, we're going to have a theme. The theme this week is first. It's our first episode, and we're going to just talk about different firsts in music. So each week we'll have a different theme. We'll share songs that kind of go with that theme. We hope that you'll enjoy the songs, and hopefully we'll introduce you guys to some new music, and hopefully we'll all have a great time.
The other reason that we're doing this is because, Dave, I don't think there are any two living authorities on music that can speak with the kind of, I think, the canonical weight than you and I have. Our credentials are very strong. Many people know us from the Slam Dunk All-Stars, a really big, pretty popular band. I think we probably made enough money just touring off that one record that we could have retired early, but we ended up just giving it away to charity, and now we're just working different jobs talking about music with our spare time.
And yeah, the fact that we played kind of all genres of music with the Slam Dunk All-Stars, I think that people really can dig what we're saying from all different angles. Even though we're two white men with advanced college degrees, I think we can see a lot of perspective in the world.
Yeah, it's a good point. So basically what we want to introduce to people here are songs on a theme. The theme tonight is firsts and firsts throughout music. Dave, before we play anything else, though, I think we need to just loosen the musical juices with another track, actually just a taste of one, from the great Cat Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of the first records my dad ever introduced to me, and my mom also liked it. You know what's coming, Dave?
No.
I would have given you all of my heart. But there's someone who's torn it apart, and she's taken almost all that I've got. But if you want, I'll try to love again. Baby, I'll try to love again, but I know. The first cut is the deepest, baby.
Dave, the first cut is always the deepest, and I want you to take us into our first cut tonight. Deepest cut, what's the first musical first you're going to present for the people tonight?
I was just thinking about all sorts of different firsts, And I wanted to share the first rock and roll song to hit number one. This is Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings to a close just about this part of the show, and we want to thank all of you for being so very nice. Before we go, though, I'd like to sing one song for you that I hope you've heard someplace before. 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Bad rags on, join me high. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
The first thing people need to know is Bill Haley has a face made for the radio, Dave.
So Steelman, like, you know, I did some research about this and I was like, whoa, Bill Haley, like, you know, great song, amazing. But he was quickly eclipsed by Elvis for reasons that are extraordinarily obvious when you look at a picture with both of them in it.
Yeah, Bill Haley's face is profoundly asymmetrical. One of his eyes looks like it's asleep. The other one looks like it's barely alert. And it's the left eye is like 3 inches higher than the right eye. Not quite the look you're going for like the teenage heartthrob. He's also in his 40s, by all appearances.
And then you pull up just a picture of him and his group, Bill Haley and the Comets, and still it looks like the cover of like Unhandsome Gentleman's Quarterly or something. Every single guy in the group is very homely. It's amazing. Yeah.
There's a fair amount of balding happening in this. They're all. And the other thing about the photo you put up, Dave, is the positioning of the men closest to Bill Haley is very uncomfortable. It looks like Bill Haley's about to proposition them.
There's something suggestive in the positioning. And yeah, I think people like a lot more what Elvis was suggesting with what he did than as opposed to what Bill Haley and the Comets are suggesting.
So that's a famous first. It's a shame that he wasn't able to hang on to the top of the charts, Dave. But I want to tell you about another first. And I wanted to look. This one was one I didn't know the answer to. This is trivia for you. Do you know the first record that sold 1 million copies in a single calendar year?
I want it to be Thriller by Michael Jackson, but I don't know. Tell me.
Yeah, I wanted it to be Thriller. I think that's the first to sell like 10 million. But the first one to sell a million actually is a pretty interesting album by a very interesting political figure, Harry Belafonte. A lot of people know him now as like an outspoken civil rights advocate and just like a really classy dude. But he made it on the scene first as like this calypso singer with a taste of like the island music. And his big hit was the Deo Banana Boat song. But there's a,
oh yeah,
the last song on this calypso record I'd never heard before. It's kind of insane. I'm going to play a little taste of it for you. It's called Man Smart, Woman Smarter.
Together to find out which one is smarter. Some say men, but I say no. The women, but the men, they should know. Not me, but the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is
Proto-feminism 60 years ago from Harry Belafonte. I don't want to ruin it by telling you, Dave, that all of the reasons that women are smarter are tremendously misogynist and sexist, but the message so far in that song is really good. You just got to fade it out after a minute and it's legend.
Yeah, he is ahead of his time in every way.
Really
was. Of course he's a classy guy. And it's a really interesting sound to top the charts with and to become so popular, because it's interesting, but there's definitely some mild irritation in it to me.
Yeah. It's like, this is vaguely exotic, but not actually indigenous enough to be not music white people could listen to.
So
it was just palatable enough to like play in Kansas City or Omaha or something, you know?
Yeah, it's sanitized calypso music, which I think we all love.
Yeah.
You know this about me. I like Bruce Springsteen.
I think that's an understatement.
I enjoy him. I did high school in New Jersey. Yeah. The only positive thing I can say about New Jersey is that I really like Bruce Springsteen. I love him. So, yeah. Steele, do you know about Bruce Springsteen's saxophone player? Do you know who he is? Do you know anything about him?
You know, I just know that he's good, but I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. Pick him out of a lineup, Dave.
So he died pretty recently. Oh. His name's Clarence Clemons.
Oh, legend.
And he's just he was a huge dude. So on the stage, he was just a presence because Clarence was 6'5", just this big guy playing saxophone. And like would dwarf Bruce Springsteen. And so Bruce on stage was always kind of play off of him. But the first I'm going to talk about is the first time that Clarence and Bruce played together. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
So Bruce was playing some little club in New Jersey in Asbury Park, where Bruce is from. It's a terrible place. I've been there once or twice.
It's called Asbury Park.
I think it's Asbury.
Okay.
It's just a single S.
I thought it was a special kind of fruit that only grew in New Jersey.
but Bruce is playing that night. It's a stormy night. It's rainy, windy. Clarence has heard him before. Clarence is kind of in the music scene in New Jersey. And in between sets, Bruce and the rest of the E Street Band is just kind of hanging out. And Clarence walks up and he opens the door. And it's unclear if this is apocryphal or not, but Clarence said this is what happened. He pulled the door and he just ripped it right off the hinges and the door blew down the street.
Oh. And this is just like a zombie movie almost.
It's this huge 6'5 man and he looks at Bruce and Bruce is, you know, feeling a little bit nervous, like what is going on? And Clarence says to him, "I want to play with your band." And Bruce said, "Sure, you do anything you want."
Smart man, Bruce Springsteen.
So the first song they played was Spirit in the Night. Clarence got up there and wailed on the saxophone, and they knew it. It was Love at First Saxophone.
Wow. That tore the door off right off my hinges, Dave.
It's destiny, Steele. You couldn't just get any guy to play that saxophone for Bruce. What first do you got for me now?
So here's
Steele.
Another first for you that was real surprising for me. So you mentioned Thriller earlier. Now, Thriller is one of the greatest selling albums of all time. But do you know what the greatest selling single of all time is?
It's got to be The Doggone Girl Is Mine. Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney, right?
You know, for some reason they haven't been updating the sales records on that one because, unfortunately, it wasn't top of the charts. The number one selling single of all time is Bing Crosby's White Christmas. It sold probably over 50 million copies. But here's my little first. I wanted to know what was the first non-English song to be the Billboard Song of the Year. And this song also happens to be the best-selling non-English language single of all time. It sold 22 million plus copies.
And you want me to guess?
No, because it's impossible to guess. I've never heard of it. But if you can, that'd be amazing.
It's got to be Menudo. And I love their whole catalog, so it's impossible to guess.
So very close. It's just a mild mispronunciation. The guy's name apparently is Domenico Modugno, which the direct inspiration for Menudo. The song is called Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu Volare. And just tell me if you've ever heard this song before, because it's sold 22 million copies. It feels like it should be better known.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dipingevo le mani e la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e incominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito.
Now he heats it up. You ready?
Volare.
Oh.
Cantare. Oh. Nel blu dipinto di blu. Felice di stare lassù. E volavo, volavo felice più in alto del sole d'ancora più su.
Nel blu, del pinto de blu. I mean, Dave, that's going to be an earworm for years.
Honestly, I really enjoyed it. I can totally see why that is a Billboard Song of the Year. I thought it was great. I've never heard it before, but I appreciate it. He was bringing all the right things. I felt kind of like it might be like Pepe Le Pew, you know, the cartoon skunk. And he's singing that song to seduce the cat that he thinks is a skunk. Like it's that smooth.
I'm pretty sure that was the underpinnings, the soundtrack for that love affair. And that was an interesting one to me because I felt like it was vaguely familiar, but I couldn't have sworn that I'd ever heard that song before. And yet it's one of the top six best-selling singles of all time. That was pretty amazing to me. So there's a first.
Steel, I wanted to, you know, I don't listen to a lot of hip-hop music. It's not something I've been super into, but I appreciate some of the songs because there's been some transcendent songs through time. So I looked, like, what's the first rap song to be number one on the Billboard charts? Do you know the answer to this one?
I'm probably going to be heartbroken, so I don't know, but...
It's I don't want to play it.
MC Hammer?
No, that would be even preferable. It's Vanilla Ice, Ice to Ice Baby.
That was the first rap song to go number one on Billboard. Ugh.
Yeah.
That's the death of rap right there.
It's never recovered from 1990. It's been over since then. Then, you know how rap rock was a thing for a while? You remember that, Steel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely. Rick Rubin.
What would you say first rap rock song, do you know?
I would have guessed it was that Aerosmith Run DMC collaboration. That one's pretty famous, I think.
Yeah. So that's it. Run DMC was in the... No, you nailed it. But Run DMC, they were in the studio with Rick Rubin, and he pulled out an Aerosmith song, and they're like, we've never heard of these guys.
They were
and
Rick washed Rubin, up, yeah.
Convinced them to do the cover, and it was fantastic. I'm not going to play any of those songs.
Okay. What are you going to play? Let's get personal, Dave. Forget firsts in history. Firsts in your life. Firsts in your life.
So, Steele, the first time that I ever played a song for my girls and for bedtime and then was so pleased with what song I played that I called you later that night, do you know what song that was?
I think I might because it just happened like last week.
So I know you love Beck, and my girls now, they call this the donkey song.
Yes.
because I guess I just don't want them to say jackass, but go ahead and play it. I love the line, "I'll put it together." It's like Beck is just, he's going to let us know. He's going to let us understand. "I'll put it together."
Yeah.
And then it's a strange invitation. He's really teaching me stuff.
Dave, that is such a great song. That record was probably, I think that's the first record that I played so much that it wore out and I had to buy another CD copy of it. Odelay was like the defining album for me of my teen years, for sure. Dave, I want to play a song that's from my personal past, and this was the first song that Laurel and I played at our wedding, like the first song we danced to. And this was a song that Laurel shared with me fairly early in our courtship, and it has a special place in our heart, and it's a really beautiful song that I actually hadn't heard before Laurel shared it with me. It's by Patty Griffin from her Living with Ghosts album, and it's called Not Alone.
I absolutely love it. That is so beautiful. Literally, you brought some tears to my eyes as I was listening to that.
That's how I feel like every time I listen to it, Dave. Man, it's one of those songs that just, the way that she delivers it, you hear her voice drop those registers. She's breathing. The song is just so intimate, and the lyrical content, that's a song that speaks to me on nearly every level and has that deep personal connection. It's a real first in my heart.
And I love just those couple of moments where she drops to almost a whisper for just a moment. That's a beautiful. It's another first still. It's the first time you've played a song that I like. So
it only took 78 episodes, Dave. All right, Dave, do you have one more first for us?
Let's finish it off. I think we've talked about a lot of really nice firsts. I think we'll finish it off a little bit more upbeat, Steele.
Yeah, I love it. Rock us out.
First concert I ever went to. 1994.
Okay. All right. Play your song, we got to talk about first concert experiences for just a second. Yours was what year? 1994.
1994. And, I'd seen like Kenny Rogers before that, but this is the first concert that I.
He doesn't count as a first concert. Poor Kenny, man.
I apologize. Well, he Yeah, I remember, if you want to get into Kenny, I remember he played a song in the Astrodome called Planet Texas. If you listen to it now, it's completely unlistenable. But like in 1988, it was pretty cool.
Dave, this is a sad confession, but my first concert was, I had to look up the title for this. The official title was The Healing in the Heartland Appreciation Concert. It was uh-huh. I was living in Oklahoma City in the mid-90s. The Oklahoma City bombing had just happened. It devastated the city, killed lots of people, including several children. And so they had this big, like, healing concert. And I looked it up, and I found a newspaper review. Here's this little list of who played. The opener, Tony Bennett. And apparently the news article notes that he joined the mosh pit at some point during his song. So I remember, like, tons of 70-year-olds, like, loving that. And then 4 a.m. came and played their big hit, Sukiyaki. It was terrible, acapella music. The Rembrandts played the theme song from Friends.
It's a great song.
Collective Soul was the band I really wanted to see. I was like, that's why I went to that show. It was basically a Collective Soul concert. There's a band called Wakeland that I always thought was going to make it real big there from Oklahoma. And they had like a theme, like a song on the soundtrack for like a C-list Tia Carrere movie that had just been released, and that was going to be like their ticket to the big time. That album's not even on Spotify. That's how obscure it is. But I had that one and played it for years. But the person I remember most from that concert, the woman who blew me away, Sophie B. Hawkins, Dave.
I'm not familiar.
She sang Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. You remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
As I Lay Me Down to Sleep. Those are her two big hits. She came out in like a white tank top and like a hippie batik skirt and like threw a bong into the crowd at one point. And probably like for a couple of years was my ideal of the world's most sexy woman after that concert. She changed my life.
It seems like a dangerous choice to throw the bong into the audience still. Like someone could get cut up. That's danger.
That's how she lived, man. She just lived on the edge. She was a free spirit. Sophie B.
Damn. Yeah.
All right. So your first show wasn't Kenny Rogers, but what is the concert and what's the song you're going to play for us?
Okay. So Meadowlands in New Jersey, 1994.
Whoa.
So probably 50,000 people there.
An arena.
A stadium.
Stadium.
So outdoor. The Rolling Stones, probably 20 years past the height of their powers. But, I mean, now they're 40 years past the height of their powers. So 1994, it was legitimately awesome. Counting Crows opened for them when the Counting Crows were a big thing.
Mr. Jones? Did they play Mr. Jones?
Of course they did. This is a different subject, but the main problem with the Counting Crows live is that the lead singer sings every song like different than what it is on the album. So like everybody's about to sing with Mr. Jones, and then he like changes how he sings it. It's really frustrating.
Great. Sounds like a real fan-friendly move.
Yeah, that is probably why the Counting Crows are still – like they would be around otherwise. But Rolling Stones set was fantastic. Mick Jagger was still moving. And they played one of my favorite Stone songs, which is Street Fightin' Man.
I just had to get to that part. The time is right for violent revolution. Revolution.
I like that it's – when I saw it, it was sung by a skinny 50-year-old man that there's no way he'd been in a street fight for over 30 years. And, yeah, it would just be bad news if he was in one.
Oh, Dave.
But that's our first, Steele. Did you enjoy our first episode?
The first of first, man. It was great. I can't think of really anything I'd enjoy more doing more on late on a Tuesday night than talking about music with you, Dave.
I'm here to make your dreams come true. Steele, I'm going to make one last dream come true for you before this episode's over.
Yeah.
You didn't know about this, but I put this kind of out on the ether. I said, hey, I put it out there. Anybody want to ask us music-related questions?
Oh, nice.
And the response was huge.
Okay.
The Ethernet just emails, questions poured in. I didn't have time to go through them all. I just picked one basically at random. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Dear theme songs.
Oh, nice.
Can you be handsome and a transcendent musician? Tom York, Bruce Springsteen, Jeff Tweedy. These aren't handsome men.
That's a great question, and I think the media answer, well, I was going to say no, Dave. I really was going to say no, but then I thought of Sophie B. Hawkins. So I'm really torn. I was thinking that might have been a question that came in from Billy Corgan, for example, like trying to justify his career, you know. But
I'm sorry. It's from Bruce in Asbury Park, New Jersey. So I didn't. Sorry, yeah, didn't think that.
I don't know, Dave. So I think point counterpoint. My first point would be probably not. You can either be like the front man and famous for your looks, and then your music's kind of subsidiary, or you can be like a pure musician, and everybody just respects you for your transcendent talent. Like, for example, Aretha Franklin. There's very few people that are going to say, "Oh, she's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen." But there's a lot of people that would say, oh, she's the most beautiful singer I've ever heard. And I think the oral component of music is like, yeah, I think it's tough to be both. I think of like Jim Morrison, The Doors, right?
Yeah.
I think everybody thinks of him as a beautiful man, but was he really a transcendent musician? Or was he just a super crazy lizard king that also was handsome?
I honestly think it's probably pretty difficult to be handsome and a transcendent musician. I think that, yeah, having the good looks, you don't want it bad enough. You don't have the hunger. Yeah. Like Tom York is one of my favorite musicians, and he is the least handsome man out there. To have that transcendence, you have to want it, and you have to have some inspiration. And I think a lot of great music, the inspiration is hardship. The beautiful song you just played by Patty Griffin, that wouldn't mean nearly as much if you'd never felt alone before.
Totally. Dave, I read a book, and I used to teach this class on music, and one of the arguments this guy made, a psychologist, was that the primary reason that men are the dominant like singer-songwriters in music, it's primarily music is a tool for sexual attraction, like as a way to attract mates. And You resort to music when your looks aren't working. So you're like, I may not look like much, but let me sing for you. And they're like, oh, well, maybe he is a worthy mate. So I think there's like a deep evolutionary reason underneath this. Ugly men tend to become singers. If they had good looks, they're like, why do I need to sing? That's kind of the short answer, I think, of Daniel Levitin was the guy who made that argument. So
there you go, Bruce. Take that to the bank. Great first, Steele. Have a great night, man.
Thanks, you too.